What does pride mean to you? Is it a party? A parade filled with rainbows and smiling faces? Is it a protest? A recognition of the Stonewall riots and the black drag queens who sparked the movement back in June 1969? For me, it's the complex history that has led to the growing acceptance that the LGBTQ plus community feel in today's society. And in that history lies one of the most surprising and influential relationships that I've ever come across. From the First World War to current day, the drag art form and the British forces have influenced each other in inextricable ways. Kit Hayam is the author of Before We Were Trans, looking at gender nonconformity throughout history. He takes us to Knockaloe, a civilian internment camp on the Isle of Man, where people were held captive during the First World War.
So they weren't prisoners of war, they'd never fought against Britain. They couldn't be made to do any forced labour, but they also couldn't work. And so they had absolutely nothing to do. There were real, real problems with mental health because of this complete kind of lack of purpose. The people who were supporting them encouraged them to do kind of productive activities like theatres.
And Kit tells me this is where the drag comes in.
Anyone who identified as male could completely step outside of their own experience by actually presenting as a different gender. And of course, for those who didn't identify as male, who felt actually more comfortable presenting as women, it offered a really unique opportunity to present in the way that they wanted to.
I wonder if it was the innocence of the time that allowed this open-mindedness.
The fact that they were in a situation where there were literally no cis women gave them a really, really valuable excuse to behave in this way. There's some interesting accounts of people who presented as women on the stage actually getting fan mail, which referred to them in feminine terms, being sexually harassed by the other internees. One lieutenant wrote a letter to the German sexologist Magnus Hirschfeld to say he'd seen a drag show and he thought that the performer was probably expressing their real self on stage, and that was why their performance was so convincing. But then he also said in this letter that the people around him, none of them had understood. So clearly there was kind of limited recognition that maybe some of these people doing drag were queer in some way, but that was not universal. There were still a lot of people who, as you say, were kind of more innocent, if you like, or not acknowledging that there could be anything going on other than simple dressing up.
And in terms of the audience, Kit has collected many positive critiques for his book.
We have reviews of shows in internment camp newspapers, which always commented on how successfully the people on stage gave the illusion that they were a cis woman. They weren't interested in kind of laughing at the parody of femininity. So that's quite revealing in terms of the kind of drag that these people were doing.
For some, this actually changed their perception of gender altogether.
There was one internee who wrote in his diary that watching these shows made him realise how much better the world would be if certain men were ladies and certain ladies men. So he's kind of developing the concept of transness being a thing through watching these drag performers and living with these people who are living as female.
Before We Were Trans discusses the development of scientific sexology in this time period, allowing for insightful conversations.
Some trans people in their interviews with sexologists actually talked about how presenting as a different gender on stage was kind of a gateway to understanding their own trans identity. And so some people were starting to understand that there might be a difference, but also that we couldn't separate them clearly. And so we need to be a bit careful as well not to entrench an absolute difference and say that drag queens can never be trans or vice versa, because that overlap continues to happen and we shouldn't erase those experiences either.
But even in this age of innocence, the internalised shame of what they were doing persisted.
There was always a lot of talk about not letting photos of people presenting as female get outside of the camps. The internment camps in particular were seen as really kind of separate spaces from the real world. People talked about the world kind of disappearing at the barbed wire. It was a space for experimentation with the caveat that people knew it couldn't necessarily continue outside of that.
But continue it did. Though drag was hidden behind barbed wire in the First World War, by the outbreak of World War II, it had become an honour for servicemen to be picked to perform in a dress. RAF intelligence photographer John Topham captured this joy in one of the most contradictory pictures taken during the conflict. At Top Photo, an independent photography library, Flora Smith and John Bullion continue to protect and share John's work, and they explained to me how the photographer ended up in this special situation.
John had a fair dose of luck. He was photographing soldiers in rehearsal who were all dressed up in their dresses and bonnets. While he was there photographing this very nice local story, the alert went off and they had to leg it in their pinafores and bonnets and race to their defences. Being Topham, of course, he just gave chase. They're hooting with laughter. I mean, certainly somebody's having a good old giggle. It's the sense of the photograph that you feel from John's work. Then they get to the guns, very, very serious, but they are in their petticoats. You know, a couple of them are in their tin hats. One is still wearing his bonnet. It's so evocative. But they take it totally seriously. You know, the dress makes no difference.
And John being there to take those pictures really changes the narrative.
From just being soldiers dressing up for a show to being soldiers dressed up, running out, you know, saving Britain, which is synonymous for the whole war effort, drop everything and go mentality. And that's what they did. What we know is that they were Shaun Mead Fortiers. The show was about 3 miles from the actual fort. There's a picture of them running up a hill. So we assume that they ran the whole 3 miles to get to the fort in their dresses before manning the guns. And John must have followed as well, you know, with his camera.
What shocked me in these photos was the incredible level of detail.
There's a shot of a soldier who's getting sort of needle and thread with his bonnet on, doing the dress. It was quite an effort for that performance, but I think it was obviously a history of soldiers in drag performing. It wasn't sort of an unusual thing.
However, what was unusual was John being allowed to take these military meet drag photos in the first place.
That's classic John. Remember, he'd been in the services. So his ability to connect, second to none. We have a later photographer called Alan Vines, who took some equally extraordinary work of a show later called That Was the Army. No women, so the guys get dressed up and have a marvellous time. It's very sort of subversive and fascinating. And Alan got behind the scenes, very resonant with John's work, a whole life being revealed to him, including a world that was clearly still illegal at that time. And he was allowed to photograph it with great care, but also revelation, if you know how to look, from these two sets of work, which are so revealing. How is it that they were so relaxed with him? But I think it was in both cases because of their own service history.
These pictures, however morale boosting, were not made public until recent years, something Flora is unsurprised by.
You know, there's no way that the government at the time would have wanted those pictures of soldiers in petticoats doing their job, a PR disaster. It's interesting because times change so dramatically. These pictures speak very clearly to a lot of people. Because they survived, they've moved from something that is too revealing and should not be seen because it's too dangerous to something that's incredibly celebratory and important.
Drag continued to be an essential morale boost to Britain during the post-war period. Professor Emma Vickers, co-author of Sissy or Sanctuary, describes the 50s and 60s as a springboard for drag culture as we know it today. This follows on from World War II, when drag performance troupes were set up and actually became the preferred form of entertainment.
The formal organisations like ENSA, for example, had their place, but tended to be slightly more mainstream. Sometimes lots of complaints about ENSA that it was a bit too sort of formal. One particular man that complained that if he heard Dame Vera Lynn anymore, he was going to go and jump off the White Cliffs of Dover because, you know, it just had enough. It was quite melancholy. So informal drag and informal performance, there were men available that would perform, and it was often just turned around quite quickly with, you know, mosquito netting or whatever they could find. They could pull on the politics of that particular group, and that's where the humour would often come from.
With the freedom and power that these shows now wielded, performances flirted just a little more with the line of same-sex desire.
Some would have been more explicit about their own desires and would have played on the tension that was created, because we did have some very openly queer men that would have been part of their units, and that would have been a known fact. For others, performance would have allowed them to kind of play around with that tension of who knows and who doesn't. So it is within the conventions of what's acceptable, but that could often be very localised.
And from the trenches to the stage, drag is brought into the spotlight.
The foundations of that desire for performance were laid by what happened during wars, created almost like a cultural knowability. In the post-war period, you do get performances by drag performers that have featured during the Second World War. They have their own kind of post-war shows. That demonstrates that actually there is a desire to see those performers again. And then you get the run into kind of the 50s and the 60s, where we do get more drag appearing on mainstream television, actually, with Danny LaRue.
But the cracks between wartime and disco drag are already starting to show.
Male performers during the Second World War were either aping women in a way that made them unattractive, or they were best manifestation of femininity that they could be. I think in the 70s and 80s, it becomes more glamorous. I think there's less kind of negative aping of women or playing around with the negative aspects of what they saw as women. And I think you get much more engagement with topical issues. I think there's much more comedy involved in the 70s and 80s as well. And you get more of a well-rounded drag performer.
As drag turns into an art form that celebrates homosexuality, the military turns its back.
Think about what's happening in the armed forces generally in that period after the Second World War. You have a very much a laissez-faire attitude towards same-sex activity. And then they realise in the post-war period that they need to tighten things up. That will have included the types of entertainment that were informally sort of engaging audiences. So it's very much a period of restoration and alignment of the rules in the post-war period. And drag is going to become a victim of that.
But you cannot keep a good drag queen down. By the 1980s, under the cloud of the AIDS crisis and the continued ban on homosexuality in the British Armed Forces, the military had distanced itself from those post-war drag performances. And yet drag continued to be popular among the civilian population. Drag queen Dame Dave Lynn tells me about his experiences in the 70s and the 80s, when the UK's biggest star was Danny LaRue, a former member of the Royal Navy.
Danny was the epitome of what drag should have been in those days. He never claimed to be a drag queen. He always said he was a man dressed up as a woman. My mum always took that from him. It wouldn't matter what part I played, it's the costume that counts. So it always stuck in my head.
As Dave innocently steps into drag, he's supported by his military predecessors.
It didn't occur to me that there was anything wrong with it, but I knew because I'd read an article once said drag was just one buff from stripping, and it was terrifying going on stage the first time because we didn't have any training those days. People would help you with your makeup. I mean, I had a great friend called Terry Gardner, who was part of the wartime group.
Now, Terry Gardner was a regular in the Forces in Frocks drag shows during the post-war period.
He taught us, he made dresses for us. This wisdom I got from the ones who had come from that era was wonderful because they were all comedy acts with a hint to being a woman, but not totally. Now that gay is so much part of life, you see gays in all walks of life. But when I was younger, people thought gays were flower shop owners, ballet dancers or hairdressers. They're these guys. There's nothing that says a cat man can't fight for, because I believe me, they can fight.
Contradicting its loud and proud self, drag often had to hide during this time for fear of being caught.
The scene was underground and there was a great fear of walking the streets. I remember people, even if you gave them a look in a pub, would start on you. I must have had a girly face or something. But in the 70s, things were changing. People were becoming much more aware. More people wanted to go and see a drag show or go to a gay club than they did a straight place.
As drag finds its feet and we head towards the 2000s, where the ban of homosexuality in the British forces is finally lifted, Dave Lynn is asked to be a professional in a TV show called Faking It. His job is to turn a civilian into a drag queen, and so he meets Spencer, an ex-Navy officer.
I think he was one of those who, in the Navy, they told him to go and do something for a joke, he'd do it. And I think that this was his biggest test. So he was very frightened. I mean, he was very nervous of the gay thing. If you watch the programme, he says it a couple of times, all this gayness around me, that I said he should live here with me. It's a very frightening thing to do drag, especially if you're a straight guy. Wow. It ended up as a really nice friendship. And Spencer was a very special man. Some people use words like puffs and fags. He wasn't like that. And then the more he was living here, the more we worked together. I mean, one night he came in to me and he said, "I'm really upset, Dave. I've just read that where we work tonight, two guys got beaten up for being gay. It really upsets me." So he changed as we went on and he became very protective over me. He used to come to work with me even when we weren't working together. And he would say, "You know, have you eaten? Do you want another drink?" It became a really, I tell you what, I think I probably got as much out of it as he did.
As Spencer moves from tolerance to acceptance, there are still a few hurdles to get over.
The day came where I said, "Now you've got to put the frock on." It was hysterical because he came back on with it, back to front, with the zip in the front.
Oh, bless him.
And then we were trying to sort of help him and Sally said, "Yeah, I've got to go out for a minute." And he left the room and I had to go to him and calm him down.
Spencer embraces the art form and performs with Dave.
He would go for it on his own, which I thought was lovely. I turned around and he was doing little side jokes to the audience very camply and very happily. And all his naval friends came and they are just so naughty. They were all so proud of him.
This understanding has now become mainstream, with role models like Lily Savage and RuPaul bringing drag once again into the spotlight. However, the once insatiable relationship between drag and the military now feels distant, almost toxic in its differences. But if anyone can understand both sides, it's Kieran Evericks, the non-binary drag performer who started their life as a military child. Kieran tells me they have no memory of drag being part of their forces childhood.
I know that for a fact when I grew up, queer or even having a conversation about being queer just wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. Homophobia was all around me. There was no sort of sign that I could even engage with that. Being a military child, you obviously go around moving different places quite regularly. It's the norm. Every single school that I went to, there was an aspect of bullying which came into like me being femme. Particularly my parents, I only sort of found this out like a few years ago, but they also experienced queer phobia in that aspect, that because of me being effeminate from other military families, I had a lot of internalized homophobia for a very long time.
From growing up excluded to becoming the drag performer that they are today, Kieran has used their childhood as an inspiration.
I have like a parental figure that I do in drag, and her name is Nan Binary. Having that sort of caricature of this old character who you would sort of look at as stereotypically quite bigoted, that's like where I sort of like take that inspiration from. Aesthetically, you think that she's going to be like this troublemaker, but her mannerisms and like what she actually exudes is nothing but love, positivity, acceptance. And she uses that sort of humor around it to not make queer people or anyone the butt of the joke. There's never going to be a joke that's at the expense of someone.
And this is an important aspect of Kieran's drag. It's the platform where their past and their present meet, and they can figure out what the next step is.
Something that a lot of queer people tend to do is create either characters or they gravitate towards people who are older than them. And sometimes you can see that like throughout drag as a whole, I think. My performances are very much based around trauma, but I can do that in such a way that is powerful and uplifting and funny.
This is where drag and the military can embrace once more. Using humour to have the hard conversations is the anchor for both industries and a necessity for Kieran to process their past.
Going through all the years that I'd experienced as a child was a means of therapy for me because it was getting it out there. You know, you can read between the lines and there's my story, but also here's a story that can be shared by a lot of people that have also experienced this. Being vulnerable, but doing it in such a way that is still remaining like you and your truth opens the doors to just, you know, be more human to other people.
And once you start digging into the conversation, there are so many potential positive overlaps.
I think knowing that trying to seek help with trauma in the military is extremely difficult, as it is for queer people. And I can sort of like see what my dad went through, and he needed help, but he won't do it. because I think there's that sort of like mindset around it. It's like you have to always be strong and all this kind of stuff. But strength can be seen in different ways. And I think when you look at drag is such a strength. It takes a lot to like get into drag.
Kieran makes a great suggestion on how to bring the military and drag back together again.
There's so much trauma within the military itself. I think the way to get around that is to just do drag.